Welcome to this week's edition of Focus Fridays here on WKLM. Focus Fridays is brought to you by Hobbins Insurance, Home Siding, Rohde's IGA, Millersburg Electric, Pomerine Hospital, MRV Siding, and Millersburg Tire. I am Melissa Patrick with WKLM's Focus Fridays, and joining with me today is Mark Woods, the Executive Director of Anazao. Thank you, Mark, for coming in and joining with us and really explaining about who Anazao is and what you guys do, who you are. And it's a great topic with May being Mental Health Month.
Yeah, happy to be here.
And so let's kind of start out with the basics. Anazao, does that mean something? How did Anazao get the name Anazao?
Yeah, so the organization that is today, Anazao Community Partners, started right around 50 years ago. And there's an interesting history. A lot of the community behavioral health agencies started around that same time. But Anazao formed, or that organization formed, way back when, specifically around helping folks maintain employment or gain employment, particularly if they were coming out of a period of substance use or if they were coming out of a period of incarceration. That organization was called the Human Resource Center, HRC. About 10 years into that organization, there was some pretty significant welfare reform across the country, and the departments of welfare became known as the Departments of Human Resources. And that created a little bit of name confusion. And this organization changed its name at that point, kind of kitschy, to Your Human Resource Center. And so for a long period of this agency's history, it was named Your Human Resource Center, or YHRC. And I actually started with the organization back when it was still named YHRC in a couple different roles over time. I was there for about 8 years that round. But the agency went through a period of transition. And in the period of time that Ken Ward was our executive director, which preceded me, Ken was interested in a few things. We were introducing some new services, a specific push toward serving more youth in the community, and also moving us from the bottom of every directory with a Y as our initial to the top of every directory by looking for an A name. And so Ken did a lot of focus groups and conversations with consultants, etc., and landed on the name Anazao, which is a Greek word or phrase that roughly translates to be restored.
Oh, that's great.
The story is used in a very famous story from a very famous book about a story of a son that leaves his home and goes off and sows his wild oats and returns home penniless and lost in the world, and his father sees him at the end of the lane and welcomes him home. And as he's in the original Greek translation of that book, as the son is running toward his father, the father exclaims, "My son was lost, but he is Anazao." That story is the story of the prodigal son found most commonly in the Bible. And so that is the name behind Anazao Community Partners.
That's a really interesting story. Not every place has a story like that on how they got named.
Right. And so my kind of shtick is I credit Ken for the name Anazao. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, he chose Community Partners because you needed something to go with that. And I credit Ken with being the Anazao part, and I focus on the Community Partners part.
And you said you were with the organization for quite a while. When did you start with them?
Yeah, forgive me not having my resume right in front of me, but something in the 2002-2004 neck of the woods, I started with then Your Human Resource Center. I was initially hired in the organization to program manage some tobacco funds. At the time, the agency had some grant funds from the state that had come out of the master settlement tobacco agreements when the state sued the tobacco manufacturers. And so my first job with the organization was to develop anti-tobacco education programs, specifically in the Amish community in Wayne and Holmes counties. And so I went about trying to figure out how to do that. Had to do a lot of learning, both about tobacco and its effects, but also on rural community and particularly the Amish community. Spent a lot of time knocking on doors and meeting people, and found myself at times in parochial one-room schools doing drug and alcohol education with kids. But that's where I started with this organization.
That's an interesting start, too.
Yeah, so I had a few different roles over the years then. Those, like a lot of grant funding does, that grant funding kind of dried up and pivoted. In the meantime, I had went back to graduate school and earned a master in social work. And so I started doing some counseling for the agency. And I worked with adolescent consumers, particularly those that had become involved with the justice system in some way. So a lot of delinquency, a lot of petty theft situations, a lot of anger management situations. And that was the bulk of my caseload. Ultimately, I ended up in a role where I was doing a lot of our quality assurance, writing a lot of our grants and contracts. Yeah, and that was kind of the end of my first season with Anazao. I left the organization after about 8 or 9 years,
mm-hmm.
went and sowed my oats in the big city, like a little bit maybe like the prodigal son. And
had to check it out and be like, ooh, no.
worked out of Stark County for the better part of a decade.
Mm-hmm.
And about 10 years into that, in the meantime, while I was not at this agency, there was some change in leadership and some change in focus. Ken Ward came in and ultimately was my predecessor. And he changed the name, got our name moved up in the directory. And
defined.
Ken called me, said, "You don't know me from Adam, but I sit in your old office, actually, and we should get together." And we got together over probably 6 months and had breakfast meetings and lunch meetings and talked about what he was trying to do in the community and to serve the local community, but also serve the system of care and to find spaces where there were gaps and where could this organization fill those gaps. And ultimately that led to me signing on to come in as, I think the title then was Director of Services. And so I was coming in as the kind of number two
mm-hmm.
in the organization. And that was 2010, 2011, 12, something like that.
Because he knew you already had a nice foot in the community from the previous work you had
right.
done. So that made sense.
Yeah. Our Director of Administrative Support, so kind of Ken's right hand, if you will, her parents were my neighbors.
Aha.
And so we stayed a little bit in contact, mostly because I would occasionally need to borrow a lawnmower or a snowplow, something like that. And I actually had called in to Jody at the time and said something about parking up the hill at her parents' house. And she said, "You should meet Ken." And this started... yeah, what ultimately lands me here today.
And so how long have you been the director then for Anazao, the executive director?
Right. So that's another maybe interesting story. About a year and a half, maybe 2 years into my tenure as the director of services, we were starting to implement some of these things that Ken and I had dreamed about for mm-hmm. months while we were meeting. And Ken started to get really sick. In fact, we first noticed that Ken was struggling to complete some applications. He would tackle a project and maybe ask me to review it. And some of the words just didn't quite make sense. And so I was keeping a little more watchful eye and like, let me help with this a little bit more. What's going on? Ken was not a particularly old man. And mm-hmm. so, you know, is something amiss here? And ultimately, Ken was diagnosed with 3 aggressive brain tumors. And the board at Anazao called me while I was on the beach on vacation and said, "We've made the decision that Ken needs to be able to retire from his daily duties. And guess what? You're the executive director." And I don't remember accepting that job exactly. I don't believe there was any kind of salary negotiation or anything like that. I simply said, "You know, tell me what you need me to do," and kind of assumed the role from there. So that was 2014, I think. And
you've been holding it down since.
Here we are.
So you just saw the need and you knew what the direction was and you just hopped right on in.
One of the things that became really clear to me while I was in Stark County serving in a very similar capacity, mm-hmm. I was the clinical director at the organization that is today Coleman Health Services. And I was responsible for the kind of raised through the ranks there. When I left there, I was a chief officer there. But I realized that this sounds maybe a little corny or a little cliche, but I think folks that are listening would probably understand this. I felt like I wasn't at home, and I felt like my community needed some help, and I could do that in my community. We were doing really good work in Stark County, but I felt like I needed to be in,
needed
Wayne,
to come home.
In Wayne and Holmes counties. Yeah.
Well, we've got so much more to learn about your role as the director and Anazal and what you do for what the Anazal does for the community. We're going to take a little break here. I am with the executive director of Anazal, Mark Woods. I'm Melissa Patrick for Focus Fridays on WKLM. Welcome back. I am with the executive director of Anazal, Mark Woods. I'm Melissa Patrick for Focus Fridays here on WKLM. And we were learning about how Anazal got its name, how you got into the director position. And so you've been in the executive director position for a while. Kind of let us know, what is it that you do as the director there? Because you're over two counties.
Yeah.
So you've got a lot of responsibility.
So fundamentally, I suppose I'm responsible for all of our funding, which is somewhere to the tune of some years a little bit more than that, somewhere between $3.5 and $4 million a year. And somewhere between, again, up and down with times, but somewhere between, say, 40 and 55 staff at any given time. And so fundamentally, that's my responsibility, managing the money and managing the programming of those 50 or so staff. On a daily basis, I'll tell you that that looks a lot like spreadsheets and meetings and repeat over and over and over. I write a lot of documents. I spend a lot of time analyzing budgets and reviewing spreadsheets and making projections. And then I spend a lot of time in meetings with stakeholders, internal and external, whether that's partners like those associated with the Mental Health Recovery Board, partners where we have programmatic connections like probation and jails and schools, or whether that's internal. How are we trying to find efficiencies? How are we working through challenges, etc. I don't do much help giving mm-hmm. to those that we serve. But hopefully, if I'm doing my job well, the work I do translates into systems and supports that my staff then have the empowerment to go out and do good help services for those in need in the community.
It's like the trickle-down effect.
Yeah. So ultimately, like, when things are going really well, I probably get a little more credit than I deserve. When things are going poorly, I also probably get a little more credit than I deserve. But I suppose that comes with the title.
It goes hand in hand. And you must be an Excel master by this point.
I like to think so. But I've got Kevin on my team that checks me there.
Excel is definitely a program to know. It helps out immensely. And so you mentioned that Anazal has a board.
Yeah.
So you guys work under a board.
Correct. So as a 501c3, a nonprofit in the state of Ohio, one of the regulatory requirements is that we're essentially operated by a governance board. So our board is six individuals. That said, because of some term limits and some turnover on our board, we've got a couple seats open right now. I didn't even think that I would be talking about that today, but I'm glad to be talking about it. Here's your official recruiting notice, listener. We're looking for a couple of community members who are looking to serve a nonprofit board. But yeah, we've got six folks, and it's been as high as about 12, but our minimum number is six, who I'm the conduit between the board and the day-to-day mm-hmm. operations of the organization. And so I'm happy to serve for that board. But yeah, six individuals are. The president of our board is Derek Hummel of Hummel Group. We've got Michael Harwood, who is another Hummel employee that is on our board. Tom Carman is an individual from Worcester. Donnie Lees, a banker from Worcester. Travis Steiner, out of Worcester, but a native Holmes County guy. I believe he's an old East Holmes golf aficionado, maybe played for the Hawks. And Jen Kinbaum is our board member. She's actually transitioning off the board, and so creating a little vacancy spot.
And so you said you've got some openings. What does it take to be a member on the board?
A big heart. It'd be awesome if you had a big wallet, or if you knew people with a big wallet, or if you were willing to talk to people with a big wallet. But a big heart, someone who has got some professional expertise. And that could be anything from an HR background or a legal background or a risk and insurance background or some experience accessing healthcare. So really, lots of people bring some either personal or professional experience that we need to make sure we're not only doing right by our funders, we're not only doing right by our staff, but ultimately we're doing right by our clients. And so we're looking for folks with a variety of experience. Some of the folks on our board are there primarily because of their personal experience or their connection with loved ones to mental health. They just also have some other...
the background they
some
need.
Some other backgrounds. But there are other folks that are on our board specifically because of their professional background and what they bring to the table there. It's not an overly difficult kind of commitment of time. That said, we are looking for board members who really want to be involved in an organization and not just a rubber stamp and not just kind of show up and listen. We want folks engaged in helping solve the problems that we face as an organization.
And how often do they meet?
So we're actually right in the middle of a revamp, if you will. And so we're shifting to a model where we're going to meet twice a month, briefly. So half hour virtual meetings twice a month. And then subcommittees that meet once a month. Those are to be determined yet. Probably more like 45 minutes to an hour. More typical kind of...
get that deep discussion in there.
Correct. Exactly it. So 2 half hours a month where it's a little more brief, informational. And then about an hour a month that's digging in.
So that's not a huge time commitment.
No.
And so this is a perfect opportunity to just get all that information
out.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Hopefully somebody hears it and is like, hey, I've always wanted to find a way to help. Because not everybody can be a social worker or go out and help, but they still want to and they don't know how.
Right. If you've got a heart for serving the least of these, those with vulnerabilities in our community, I'd love to have a conversation about how you could fit with our board.
Wonderful. Well, this turned out into a nice opportunity to share what your board does and hopefully get you a couple new members.
Yeah, absolutely. They, like me, spend most of their time looking at spreadsheets and in meetings, but we are making some shifts intentionally around really helping them find spaces to dig into the organization, not just from a fundraising perspective. A lot of nonprofit boards spend a lot of time in fundraising. And that's an important piece that I don't want to sugarcoat. We do need to spend time in that. But for example, another big initiative right now that we're focused on is having the board help dig into staff support. So how are we making sure not only our compensation and our benefits are where they need to be, but also helping plan some staff recognition activities, for example, that we want to make sure are happening. Folks like those that work in the insurance industry, those that work in the banking industry, have a lot to offer because, frankly, at their workplaces, they do this stuff well.
Mm-hmm.
And so we want to beg, borrow, steal those ideas, bring some of those into nonprofit. And so having them engaged in those conversations is really valuable.
It's important to really, that's kind of the mental health part of your staff.
Absolutely.
And you, while you're busy helping everybody else, you don't want to forget those who are helping.
Absolutely. There's a phrase out there that I like to make a little bit of a twist on. You all sorts of these sort of passe phrases, broken people are broken or broke people are broke. What I like to talk about is people who've been helped help. And our staff, by and large, have some personal connection. You're not entering nonprofit work because you expect to make giant piles of money. You're entering that work because your heart is enormous. And we need to be careful as an employer to make sure that that enormous heart is being cared for and supported.
Well, that is a great place to kind of take a pause here. We'll learn more about what it is Anazal does with those big hearts and how they get their funding as we continue in talking with Executive Director Mark Woods. with Anna's Out. I'm Melissa Patrick for Focus Fridays on WKLN. We're going to go ahead and step back in here with the executive director of Anna's Out, Mark Woods. I'm Melissa Patrick for WKLM's Focus Fridays. And in our last segment, we kind of tiptoed around the funding of Anna's Out. You said earlier in also that you are a nonprofit. And so I didn't realize you guys had 55 people or so working for you. I thought it was a lot smaller than that. So where all are you guys getting the funding and how do you support staffing on that?
Right. So the mission of the organization, unstated, is to serve those kind of vulnerable populations in our community. Our mission is to swiftly meet the behavioral health needs of our community. So I want to emphasize that everyone in our community who has unmet behavioral health needs, we have a way to serve. That said, a core group of our consumers are those with fewer financial means than others. Mm-hmm. It's not to say that we don't serve a whole lot of folks with financial means. We do have ways to do that. But our largest funding source by a lot is Medicaid, providing counseling and case management services to individuals with Medicaid eligibility. The next kind of largest pool there are what we would call our grants and contracts area. So we have funding from the Mental Health and Recovery Board, the United Way of Wayne and Holmes Counties, both Wayne and Holmes Counties Department of Job and Family Services that are often, in fact, I think exclusively tied to measures of against the federal poverty line. And so way over about 80% of our funding ties in some way to funding eligibility based on poverty status. Mm-hmm. And that's the core bit of our business. And collectively, that's probably somewhere in the $3 million range a year as a total. Then we provide services through private insurance as well, commercial insurance that you or I may have, and families that look pretty middle class, in fact, probably doing better than middle class in a lot of cases. Those insurance companies generally authorize quite a lower payment for services than Medicaid, for example. And so there's fee to folks over a certain income level. So we operate on a sliding fee scale. Basically, the lower your family income, the lower your fee for services is going to be. Some folks do not pay anything for our services. A large swath of who we serve don't have any fee at all for services. And then you can be making pretty sizable family income and still be at a discounted rate for care. Yeah. And that's a way that we make sure that we can serve everyone, no matter where in the socioeconomic status they are, as long as they are a Wayne or Holmes County resident with a behavioral health need.
And a lot of times folks use money as a way, well, I can't afford to get help or I can't afford to go see somebody or talk to somebody. And you're like, well, guess what? Hey, we have opportunities for you to get help.
Right. One of the things that my leadership team and I spend all of our time on is trying to remove those barriers that keep someone from accessing needed care. Sometimes that means we're looking at our sliding fee scale and how can we adjust that. We don't have a lot of control over our rates because those are generally set by Medicaid. And as someone who bills against Medicaid, we can't operate with rates different from that. So we don't spend a lot of time in rate management, but we spend time in utilization management. Where do we need to be such that our consumers can receive the care that we need? But we also tackle those same barriers to care in things like looking at our hours and looking at where we co-locate, because we're trying to make accessing behavioral health care. I use the phrase behavioral health care. I want to sort of demystify that phrase. It's just shorthand for the combined total of mental health, trauma, substance use, family dysfunction. It's just a little faster for us to say behavioral health care.
Well, and all that affects your behavior.
Absolutely. So we want to be really easy for anyone with need to get into, whether that means moving where we provide the care, whether that means making sure that finances aren't a barrier to that. That's where we spend a lot of our executive functioning time.
It's where all those spreadsheets come in.
Indeed.
But it's great that you're working to remove those, because money can cause a lot of stress, which can cause mental health issues, or trying to get money can cause, I mean, it kind of ties in a lot there.
Right. So an example, one of our largest lines of programming or lines of services is our co-location in local schools. So we are very, very embedded in local schools. We are not in every local school district, but if you're listening to this, there's a really good chance we've got co-located providers in your school or your child's school. And the reason we made that push was there are more barriers, and in fact, some of them financial, than simply paying for the cost of, say, counseling or the cost of case management. How and when you get to our office is a barrier. And that involves transportation. It also involves gas. It also involves time. And if we can take that sort of show on the road, we've eliminated those barriers for you, not only making it affordable, but also making it accessible.
And that is a good way to really reach the youth population being in the schools.
Absolutely. So the largest swath of our care, probably cut right around 80% of the care we deliver, is to individuals that are under 18 years old, kids. And that's on purpose. That's an intended focus for us. It's not that we don't also serve adults and families. We certainly do. But very intentional focus of ours to serve vulnerable kids in the community. And so when we put a therapist embedded 5 days a week out at West Holmes High School, the reason is not only are there kids there who need that care, but they are unlikely to get that care if they have to come to the office. And frankly, it's hard for us to manage that, because if every kid in care needs an appointment after school, there's only so many hours and only so many office spaces. And so it's a lot easier on us if we can do that throughout the school day. You have a study hall, you instead fill that study hall with a counseling session instead of a study hall. And then your parents not trying to figure out how to get you from West Holmes High School out to our office, you know, by 3:30 for an appointment.
And so that's a great place to kind of take a moment here. We'll talk more about how you're working with the youth in our community in our next segment. That is Mark Woods, the executive director of Anazao. I'm Melissa Patrick for WKLM's Focus Fridays. And we are going to return here with Mark Woods from Anazao. He's the executive director. I'm Melissa Patrick with Focus Fridays on WKLM. And in our last segment, we really started touching in on how a lot of your focus at Anazao is in youth services. And it's like you're going ahead and starting them young, working on any trauma they may have now, so that it doesn't snowball later when they're an adult.
Yeah, absolutely. We want to serve adults with needs in our community. And part of our reality is that adults, especially after the age of, say, 26, 30, something like that, some of those patterns where we could intervene and change trajectory, we're almost late on. The work is going to be a lot harder to get to a place of healing for a 32-year-old versus a 12-year-old. That 12-year-old, we think we can make an impact on, and hopefully make an impact on their family as well, such that we don't end up then with a 32-year-old with some of the same struggles that they might have otherwise had. This ultimately means that they're contributing in their local community, they're becoming teachers, coaches, supporters of other kids, they're attending churches and providing offering, they have stable jobs, and they just improve the total community if we can help early. We identified, I mentioned earlier, back when I came back on with Ken, we identified a gap in the community, which was not only in child services, there was not enough in the way of child behavioral health care, but no one was serving embedded in schools. And so we really made a gigantic push to figure out how to make that work. It is challenging because we, for example, if you're an office-based therapist, you generally have about an hour-long session with each of your clients. That is not true when you're embedded in a school. When you're embedded in a school, you're on a bell schedule. That might be a 45-minute schedule, but it also might be a 25-minute schedule. You got to do that same amount of heavy emotional lifting in a much different way. We don't always get it perfect, but we have, I think, pretty well mastered how to deliver care embedded in local schools. And that's far and away our biggest service line.
And if you're in the schools consistently, you're familiar to the students and you're a familiar face. You're not a stranger that they're being dropped off in some office to talk to. They know you. They see you every day. They feel comfortable sharing what the issue is.
Absolutely. So the number one reason people don't access care is stigma. Stigma, complicated word maybe, but essentially it's any of those icky, ill feelings I have about, I'm not going to go talk to somebody. I'm not going to go lay down on some psychiatrist's couch and tell them all about my daddy issues. P.S. That's not really what we do. We don't.
We have no couches.
We really don't have any couches.
We sit in chairs these days.
But that stigma comes from some old ingrained ideas about asking for or needing help means that you're weak. And that's simply not true. The world's gotten a lot harder since even when I was a kid. And frankly, my world was a lot harder than when my mom was a kid. And we're just trying to provide a space to kind of name that and recognize it. Being co-located, being embedded is a strategy that, first of all, yeah, it's absolutely strategic. It is part of what we're trying to do. But it is also with the sort of servant's intention of how do we make this not just easy to get to and easy to afford, but easy to accept. And so trying really hard to reduce stigma around accessing care. It's a little bit easier if you don't have to sort of sheepishly walk to an office.
Right. Nobody knows. You're right. Walking to a classroom like you would any other time. And being in the schools also lets you guys see some of the trends that are happening.
Absolutely.
And can jump on maybe, okay, we could be seeing some of this. How can we prepare for that? It's a lot easier to do that than being in a whole different building and waiting until the fallout from whatever this may end up being.
Absolutely. And in the schools where we're embedded, one of the things that emerges is we become the sort of right size and shape to support school staff doing what they need to do. Fundamentally, their job is to educate.
Mm-hmm.
And so a guidance counselor, for example, can certainly sit down with a child who's experiencing depression. And probably that period of time that they have to give that child is going to be valuable. But a guidance counselor has 17 other things that they need to be doing. And if that child is high enough need, and by that I simply mean they've got a diagnosable behavioral health condition. This isn't, I'm sad because of one thing that happened last night, but this is genuine depression.
Over time,
right.
Build up.
Then we're going to come in and we can carry that ball. So that allows the guidance counselor the time and energy and capacity to deal with the rest of their job. And so if they're dealing with sort of those tier one needs, we can deal with the tier two and three. And ultimately, the whole environment improves because we're doing our lane and they're able to stay in their lane. Guidance counselors weren't trained to do deep end mental health counseling. That's not their role. They have 287 other things to do. They're going to be that voice of support for kids, of course, but we're able to come in and kind of like a specialty doctor carry that.
They can kind of see, you know what, this is a bigger problem than what I can handle. I'm going to give it to the people who deal with this every single day.
Right.
And have better resources than myself.
Absolutely. So I think sometimes folks, particularly in Holmes County, it's easy to say, I'm kind of depressed, but I talked to my pastor about that. Well, that's awesome. I'm so glad you have that relationship with your pastor. P.S. Your pastor has some training in that,
mm-hmm.
but is not likely also a master's trained therapist. But that's what you're getting at our school or in our other co-located situations at our office. So we don't run in conflict with a pastor. In fact, we know that you're better off if you've got people like pastors, coaches, teachers.
Somebody to talk to.
Absolutely. But just like when you know, if you have the flu and you're just feeling down for 2-3 days, you probably don't need to go see a physician. Drink your Gatorade, have some chicken noodle soup, and you're going to be okay.
Watch Price is Right.
Absolutely. But if you're sick like the flu for a week or two or three, you need to go see a doctor.
You need some special care.
Mental health care is the same. If that sadness doesn't go away, if that stays this sort of lingering, ongoing condition, and it starts to infiltrate all of those areas of life, that's the time, that's the signal to say, I need something a little bit more than my home treatment or my supportive friend or my deep breathing app on my phone. I probably need some professional help here.
How can I deal with this?
Absolutely. Again, our schoolwork, our embedded clinicians at county jails, our community-based care, our case managers exclusively work out in the community as opposed to in the office. That's all an effort at this same idea that we want to get the help to you in the easiest way for you to use it, rather than us needing to say, sure, we're open 9 to 5, come on in whenever you can. That puts a lot of focus on someone who's not feeling well to make themselves get to the help. We instead take the approach. That's what I talk about when I say we're community partners. We're going to step in to those spaces to make that easier.
Because it's all about helping to improve the community.
Absolutely.
We've got more to learn about Anna's Out from director Mark Woods. I'm Melissa Patrick for Focus Fridays on WKLM. We're going to hop back into the conversation here about what Anna's Out does for our community. I am with the executive director, Mark Woods. I'm Melissa Patrick for Focus Fridays here on WKLM. And we've talked a lot about different things that you do. And you said that you guys offer 3 main services.
Correct. So fundamentally, it may look a little different depending on the space we deliver it. But fundamentally, we deliver 3 services to the community. Counseling, case management, and service coordination. The simple summary of those is counseling is often, but not exclusively, one-on-one. We can deliver that in a group format. That's the classic sort of image of laying down on a couch and spilling your emotional guts out on the table. We're going to talk about and use a variety of talk therapies and active exercises to work through your feelings, why you're having those feelings, how to control and manage those feelings, and kind of recognize patterns. Case management is, whereas counseling is like the doctor side of our world, if it were more of a medical look, case management is more the nursing side. So it's a little more concrete. Case managers focus on making sure basic needs are met, getting connection to needed resources, etc. The concept works a little bit like this. If you're an incredibly depressed individual and you're trying to get some help with that, but you don't have food, clothing, and shelter handled, then you're really not in any sort of state to be able to address your deep-seated depression.
Because you got other problems that are immediate.
Absolutely.
Needs versus wants.
And so our case managers come in and address those and help you address those food, clothing, shelter, those basic needs and those independent living skills. Sometimes those happen concurrently. So you've got a case manager and a counselor at the same time, and they're working on the same sorts of things. So your counselor might talk about, here's some strategies I want you to use this week to try and tackle your depression. And your case manager actually takes you out in the community and you practice with them. So that's an example of some concurrent. Other times, we provide case management first, because until we've solidified some of these things, you're really not going to be able to benefit from the counseling. Still, other times, you don't need both. You might need just counseling or just case management. And so we've got that whole array. Service coordination is a little bit more unique a service. There's some specific eligibility criteria. We are the official service coordination mechanism for both Wayne and Holmes counties. So that operates through the local Family and Children's First Councils. The concept is relatively simple, though. Service coordination is the role where we pull all of the various systems together that are serving a family or a child. So if you're involved with juvenile court, and school and have a therapist, and your mom's got a therapist somewhere else. The service coordinator's job is to get all of those people connected and a plan developed for how are we wrapping all of that service around a family and making sure communication's happening there. Ultimately, a lot of the work that service coordinators end up doing involves when there's either a need to look at some sort of out-of-home placement for a child, or more often, an opportunity to bring a child home from out-of-home placement. So out-of-home placement meant this kiddo is severe enough and has big enough needs or is dangerous to those in his family that he needs to go be in a hospital situation or a group home situation, some sort of residential treatment. And then service coordinators play the role of helping be the bridge that brings that kid back home. Because ultimately, the goal in those situations is to restore a family to functioning. Sometimes service coordination happens on the other side, where this family situation is falling apart, and to keep everyone safe, we need to be about the work of helping get that kid into an alternative situation. But we really prefer the other side of that work.
And you'll hear that with anybody who works with troubled youths. The goal is to keep them with their family and
Absolutely.
Figure out the problems that are causing the issues within the family.
Right. So what you or I might define as a dysfunctional family is still a family. And there are connections there that work better than any other connection in life. The connection between a mom and a child, the connection between siblings, etc. And so it's always the best case if we can maintain those things. So collectively, Anazao then delivers counseling, case management, and service coordination to somewhere between 1,300 and 2,500 clients a year, depending on the year and depending a little bit on how you count. One of those areas that moves that number is we do a lot of prevention education where we might serve, say, 40 or 50 kids in a day with some education, but all 50 of those kids aren't open as clients to care.
Right. And really any kind of little help is important, whether it's sitting on the couch or not.
Indeed. So some of those prevention efforts we talk about are drug education in schools is a heavy piece. Suicide prevention in schools. Kids in Ohio, there's legislation that says kids in Ohio have to have an approved evidence-based suicide prevention training. And so we're an organization that does that training for schools. So we get brought in and we might talk to every sixth grader in health class. So they've been contacted by Anazao. We wouldn't exactly call them an Anazao client.
So things have really changed, especially in the schools. We didn't have that in school, but they have so many more things coming at them now that we didn't have. We didn't have cell phones where anybody could text you, message you, DM you, hit up your TikTok or your Snapchat
right.
or any of that. They've got a lot coming at them.
This sounds a little bit tongue-in-cheek, and I'm guilty of it. My son's actually a student at Central Christian, and right now he's his health teacher's taking them all through a phone fast. And so they're working at how connected are you to your phone? And look, I'm incredibly guilty of overusing my phone myself. But one of the realities that I know when I was growing up, I might have a big blow up at school. Disagreement with somebody, or goodness gracious, the girlfriend dumped me at school. What happened then in the natural state of things is I'd go home, probably make a phone call or two. But frankly, I had to do that from the one phone
in the
living room or the kitchen.
With the long cord.
With mom listening in. And so that wasn't all that long. And then round about 8 o'clock, everything stopped. There really wasn't a way to keep that conversation going. And certainly by the time the next morning rolled around, whatever trauma had befallen me, totally old news, and it's gone. And I could move forward. That's simply not a reality for kids these days.
It's constant.
And it's never off. There's a lot of FOMO, fear of missing out, around if I am the first one to sort of shut the phone down for the night, that I'm missing out while people are talking about me. It's a constant state of anxiety. I'm not sure I know the solution. Tongue in cheek, I would say, can we all get together and agree that like 7 p.m. all the cell phones stop working and at 7 a.m. they go back online? I get that that's probably unrealistic and I would be probably one of the people complaining about it.
Right.
But
I can't go through my Facebook reels.
Right. But boy, life is different these days and the pressures on our kids in particular are just different. But those pressures on kids impact families as well. If you're a parent listening, I hear you. I've raised three teenage boys, and their lives are different than the lives I grew up with. And it's not to say it's better or worse, and I'm not saying my mom had it all that easy.
Back in my day.
Right. But it is different.
100%. Now, I know it's still really early in, but are you seeing any difference in the kids' mental health at the school now that they're not allowed to have their phones on at school?
Right. So pretty early still.
I was going to say, we're still very, very early. Was there trouble transitioning?
Right.
I guess some
very loose anecdote is maybe a little bit of an impact there. I think this is probably a well-known secret, is that kids have also figured out alternative ways to stay connected.
What?
Right.
These kids are so ingenuitive.
I don't know that it's quite the... It's probably a Band-Aid more than it's stitches over the wound that we have there. But everything helps. What I think probably the biggest help is stigma reduction. We've really come a very long way from even in the last decade of making it okay for kids to say, you know, I'm not okay right now and I need to talk to somebody. That I have seen a discernible difference in.
And while the stigma still is very large and present, it's good to be seeing it start to shift in the other direction.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, I was born east of Cleveland. I'm a transplant Holmes Countyan. I church in Berlin. I married a girl from, ultimately she was sort of from the Walnut Creek area. So I feel like Holmes County rooted, but I'm a muggle,
roots.
If you will. But I claim this neck of the woods. I live in Mount Eaton, so my sort of turn of phrase is I don't live in Holmes County, but I could hit a golf ball to Holmes County. Mm-hmm. So I'm right there and really resonate with this community. This is area where I've decided to raise my family and to put my stakes down and engage in my community. And so I say this with a finger pointed out, but also coming from a compassionate place. We've not been great locally at saying it's okay to get help. We have room for
growth.
Your care if you will come and get it. There is a lot of availability in our schedule. What we need is folks to walk through that door and say, hey, maybe I'm a little uncomfortable. Maybe I'm not quite sure what to expect of this, but I know that what I'm doing right now isn't working and I need some help.
And with that, we're going to take a quick little break and we're going to wrap up with what Anna Zal does here in our last segment with Executive Director Mark Woods. I'm Melissa Patrick for WKLM's Focus Fridays. We are back one last time with Executive Director Mark Woods from Anna Zal, and I'm Melissa Patrick from Focus Fridays here on WKLM. And as we wrapped up that last segment there, we were really getting in on the stigma and changing that stigma on reaching out for help. And I guess one of the easiest ways to help do that is tell people how they can reach out for help.
Yeah. So we do some novel things at Anna Zal to try and make that easier to do. There's a link on our website. It's a long word. Sorry. It's Anna Zal, A-N-A-Z-A-O, communitypartners.org. I know it's a long domain name.
But nobody else has it.
It is unique. If you go out to our website or just Google Anna Zal Worcester or Anna Zal Millersburg and you'll find us. Top right corner of that website, there's a button that says something like click here to request care or something like that. If you click that, you're going to be taken to a form where you fill out some pretty basic information, contact information, a very little bit about why you might be interested in some care. And sometime in our next business day, you're going to get a call from a member of our access team. They're going to call and say, hey, we have an appointment today. Do you want to come in today? And you know, take that or leave it. We'd love you to take it. But they'll get you scheduled and connected to care. That care, unfortunately, because we live in a managed care environment, means that it starts out with needing to do some paperwork and needing to answer some questions. So that intake and that assessment are the next thing that happen. You come in and spend about an hour. We get to know you a little bit. What's going on in your life, etc. But that's the gateway. That phone call or that first session, you know how much care is going to cost you. Oftentimes it's zero. You know what kind of care we'd recommend, and you're scheduled for an appointment for an ongoing provider. That can happen as early as the same day. It is typically happening for us somewhere between 1 and 3 days. So we take a lot of pride at moving very, very quickly at the front end, because we've recognized it's taken a lot of courage, a lot of gumption for someone to finally pick up that phone or go online and enter that information.
And you don't want to lose them.
We don't want to lose them. We want to be really, really responsive right in that moment. You don't have to use a website. You can pick up the phone and call. If you call 264-9597, you're going to reach that same access team. They're going to take that same information and they're going to get you scheduled to come in. You have different ways of coming in for that first appointment too. We'd love to see you at one of our offices and do that in person, but we also offer telehealth for those initial appointments as well. And we can actually, so telehealth, we're using Google Meet as the platform there. Mm-hmm. And so we can actually see you on the other end. We'll send you a link and get you set up with that. Or we can actually do that telephonically as well. And so we're trying to make that as easy as possible. Fundamentally, we're also able to do that as a home visit or as like, we'll meet you out at Jitters. Any way that we can figure out how to have that first interaction. There's no way for us to do that, to sort of skip over the first step. We have to have that first step. But we can have all the flexibility in the world about when and how we do that.
That first step is always the hardest.
It is indeed. Try to make it as painless as possible. You're going to need to bring things or provide things like your insurance information, your household income, how many people live in your home, etc. A lot of people get a little worried. Why do you need all that information? Almost always, that is because if we have that information, we can find one of our funding sources that will subsidize the care for you. So that's what makes the care either free or very reduced cost. You certainly don't need to provide any of that, but if you don't provide any of that, we may have fewer avenues available to pay for that care.
And why not remove those barriers?
Absolutely.
And you are a health provider, so you are held to the same rules of not sharing people's information as other healthcare providers.
Yeah, absolutely. So there, many folks will be familiar with HIPAA from their healthcare provider. You sign that notice at least once a year when you go into your medical provider. We're actually constrained by multiple laws, not just HIPAA. So our information is more protected, not less. And yeah, you can rest assured that that's safe, secure information that we're using in order to make a diagnosis. That diagnosis leads to how are we going to treat you?
And that's probably, I think, a little part of that stigma too, is that people are worried if I tell somebody I don't know, my info is going to be out all over.
Absolutely.
To everybody. And that is not the case.
We don't send that information out to anywhere. we're not sharing it publicly. We're not even sharing it so we share it aggregately, but we're not sharing it individually to even like payer sources. It doesn't move through our systems those ways. Your information is unique to you and is really well protected. And so I hope that that could be some assurance that that need not be a barrier.
And as we get ready to wrap up here, is there anything that we missed that folks need to know about Anazao and the services they provide?
I always think it's good to tell you that we've got offices in Millersburg and in the Bargain Hunter building, kind of right down the hill from WKLM. We've got two offices in Worcester. They're right next door to each other on Back Orville Road. Likely as not, we have the ability to see you at home. We have the ability to see you in the community. And likely as not, we're embedded wherever your kid goes to school. So any of those front doors are a perfectly viable way to get through our front door.
And you're there with a handshake and a ready to welcome.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for joining with me today and helping to share what it is that you and Anna Zau are doing for our community.
I appreciate the time. Happy to serve this community. Like I said earlier on, this is home.
And you got to take care of home.
Absolutely.
That was Mark Woods, the executive director of Anna Zau. I'm Melissa Patrick for Focus Fridays on WKLM. Focus Fridays has been brought to you by Hobrins Insurance, Home Siding, Rohde's IGA, Millersburg Electric, Pomerine Hospital, MRV Siding, and Millersburg Tire. Make sure to tune in each Friday for Focus Fridays in the 9 a.m. hour. If you happen to miss an episode of Focus Fridays, you can go to the website, WKLMFM.com, click on the Focus Fridays icon, and then click on the episode you missed from there. In the next episode of Focus Fridays, we join with Nicole Williams, the executive director of the Mental Health and Recovery Board. It's all here on your hometown radio, 95.3 WKLM.